Mimi Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I have been waiting for their father since 1 p.m. They told me that they were going to hand him over to me, and then at 10 p.m., we started to see smoke billowing from everywhere. Everybody ran away, but they left the men locked in. Everybody was removed from the area, but they left the men locked in. They never opened the door.
At least 38 migrants held in a Mexican immigration detention jail near the U.S. border have died in a fire after guards refused to help the men trapped inside. We'll go to Ciudad Juarez for the latest. Then to the fight over TikTok, as a bipartisan group of lawmakers moved to ban the Chinese-owned social media app, some lawmakers are pushing back.
We can keep TikTok, we can protect freedom of speech, and we could deal with the privacy concerns at the same time. We could do both, and right now we're not trying to do both.
We'll speak to award-winning technology journalist Julia Angwin about her piece, Banning TikTok is Not the Answer. Then Bootstrap, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. We'll talk to author Alyssa Court, who runs the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Mexico, hundreds of asylum seekers gathered in Ciudad Juarez Tuesday demanding justice after at least 38 people were killed during a fire at an immigration detention jail just feet from the border with El Paso, Texas. Over two dozen others were seriously injured. The blaze Monday broke out after dozens of migrants set their mattresses on fire, protesting their deportations as well as abusive and inhumane conditions at the overcrowded jail run by Mexico's National Migration Institute. Surveillance footage released Tuesday also shows guards quickly walking away when the fire started, making no attempt to release the migrants as flames and smoke engulfed their cells. At least 28 of the victims were from Guatemala, according to officials, while others killed and injured were from Venezuela, Honduras, El Salvador, Colombia, and Ecuador. This is Daniela Marquez, an asylum seeker from Venezuela, at yesterday's protest in Ciudad Juarez.
We demand justice for those who were inside the migration center. They had been there inside for a month. They cried out of hunger because they didn't give them food. It's not fair, honestly. The victims have families. Their mothers are in Venezuela. How is that possible that their mothers have to cry for them that far away? It's not fair, honestly. I don't have the words to express what I feel, honestly.
After headlines, we'll go to Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, for more. More information has emerged about the Nashville school shooter who killed six people Monday, three of them 9-year-old children. This is Nashville Police Chief John Drake.
We've determined that Audrey bought seven firearms from five different local gun stores here legally. They were legally purchased. Three of those weapons were used yesterday during this horrific tragedy. She was under care, doctor's care, for an emotional disorder. Law enforcement knew nothing about the treatment she was receiving, but her parents felt that she should not own weapons.
A motive for the massacre has not yet been identified. Police body camera footage shows Nashville officers stopping the rampage 4 minutes after arriving on the scene. The police response has been compared to last year's mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, where officers waited for well over an hour before confronting the shooter. While 21 people, including 19 children, were massacred, almost all of them Latinx. Russia says it's begun drills with its Yars intercontinental ballistic missile system in a show of military might. Meanwhile, Ukraine's received a first shipment of Leopard and Challenger armored tanks from Germany and Britain amid intense fighting in the country's east. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, is visiting the site of Europe's largest nuclear power plant in Zaporizhzhia today. President Volodymyr Zelensky told Rossi the safety at the nuclear power station cannot be guaranteed as long as it remains under Russian occupation and what he called Moscow's radiation blackmail. Grossi said Tuesday talks to stem the risks of a nuclear disaster are ongoing.
It might be possible to establish some form of protection, perhaps not emphasizing so much the idea of a zone, but on the protection itself, what people should do or shouldn't do to protect instead of having a territorial concept.
In Russia, a man whose 13-year-old daughter drew an anti-war picture at school was sentenced to 2 years in prison in a case that sparked international outrage. Alexei Moskalyov, however, has apparently escaped his house arrest, and authorities said Tuesday his whereabouts are unknown. His daughter, whose drawing featured a Ukrainian mother and child under a barrage of missiles, was removed from her home and put in a shelter. The owner of The Guardian issued an apology Tuesday for the British newspaper's founder's role in transatlantic slavery. The Scott Trust published research that shows Guardian founder John Edward Taylor and investors gained much of their wealth from the cotton trade after importing the cotton from North America, where it was cultivated by enslaved Africans on plantations. The findings came as part of an independent investigation commissioned in late 2020 by the Scott Trust. The Guardian also announced a 10-year, $12 million restorative justice program, which includes supporting black journalists. British Nigerian historian and member of the Scott Trust, David Alusoga, is featured in a video as part of The Guardian's report, as well as a written piece in which he describes how British ties to the transatlantic slave trade have been obfuscated.
The Guardian, like thousands of institutions in Britain, has direct financial connections to the world of slavery. That reality can't be negotiated with. It can't be explained away. This history can never be solved, can never be remedied, but it can be something good can come from it, but it needs to be a dialogue.
In Burma, the ruling military junta dissolved 40 political parties, including Aung San Suu Kyi's NLD party. NLD and others did not meet a registration deadline for the yet-to-be-scheduled election, which most civilian parties deem illegitimate. 77-year-old Aung San Suu Kyi was deposed and arrested in February 2021 military coup and is now serving prison sentences totaling 33 years. The UN reports the humanitarian and human rights crisis in Burma is continuing to deteriorate, with mass arrests, torture of prisoners, the killing of civilians, and media repression. Back in the United States, in Idaho, the State House passed a bill that would criminalize the act of helping someone under the age of 18 obtain an abortion in another state without parental consent. The bill is now headed to the Idaho Senate, where it's also expected to pass. Almost all abortions are now illegal in Idaho following the repeal of Roe v. Wade. With the proposed measure, state Republicans created a new crime, so-called abortion trafficking, with penalties of 2 to 5 years in prison. The legislation also applies to mail-order medication abortions, meaning an older relative who drives a minor to the post office to pick up a package containing abortion pills could end up in prison. A federal judge has reportedly ordered former Vice President Mike Pence to testify to the grand jury investigating Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Special Counsel Jack Smith, who's overseeing the grand jury, subpoenaed Pence earlier this year. While the judge ruled executive privilege does not shield Pence from testifying, Pence could avoid certain lines of questioning thanks to a constitutional clause known as speech or debate that's intended to protect lawmakers from some forms of legal action. Pence could still appeal the judge's decision. Meanwhile, former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker testified again this week before the Manhattan grand jury looking into alleged hush money payments made to Stormy Daniels during Trump's 2016 campaign. Pecker said to have helped broker the deal between Daniels and Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen. The Washington Post reporting Ginny Thomas, wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, collected nearly $600,000 in anonymous donations for a conservative group called Crowdsourcers for Culture and Liberty. It's not the first time Ginny and Clarence Thomas have come under scrutiny for conflict of interest issues. In 2020, Ginny Thomas urged White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to pursue efforts to overturn Donald Trump's election loss and pressured officials in Arizona and Wisconsin to choose pro-Trump electors. Justice Thomas was the sole dissenter in the Supreme Court's 8-1 decision that led to the release of White House documents around January 6. In other news from Washington, President Biden and Republicans remain at odds over how to handle the debt ceiling, as Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy requested a meeting with Biden Tuesday to push for spending cuts before agreeing to raise the debt limit. The White House and Democrats have rejected this idea. Republicans agreed to raising the debt ceiling with no conditions three times during Trump's presidency. Yesterday, advocacy groups joined with progressive lawmakers to demand Republicans stop cutting essential social services, including Medicare and the food assistance program SNAP, which was recently slashed after being increased during the pandemic. This is April Lewis from Action North Carolina.
Conservatives are trying to increase costs, paperwork, and bureaucracy that will only put families like mine at risk of losing access to food assistance and increasing the risk of homelessness, because the same conservatives are increasing costs for low-income families by protecting tax loopholes for the wealthy. These wealthy stakeholders and corporations should pay their fair share, and by reversing the Trump tax cuts alone would save $2 trillion.
And a Maryland appeals court has reinstated the murder conviction of Adnan Syed. Less than 6 months after prosecutors in Baltimore dropped charges against him last October, asserting he was wrongly convicted. Syed was released from prison in September following 23 years behind bars for the 1999 murder of his ex-girlfriend, Haemin Lee. The appeals court Tuesday ordered a new hearing on Syed's conviction, saying the rights of Haemin Lee's brother, Young Lee, had been violated when he wasn't given adequate notice to travel from California to attend last year's proceedings in Maryland in person. The case gained national attention in 2014 when it was featured on the hugely popular podcast Serial. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, where a fire has killed at least 38 migrants held in a Mexican immigration detention jail Monday night, injured dozens more. The fire occurred just across the U.S. border near the Santa Fe International Bridge to El Paso, Texas. Surveillance video from the jail shows guards walking away as flames spread inside the jail cells. In the video, guards made no effort to open the jail cells or help the migrants who were trapped. Mexican officials initially said most of the dead were Venezuelans, but authorities in Guatemala say 28 of the victims were from Guatemala. Others killed and injured were from Venezuela, Honduras, El Salvador, Colombia, and Ecuador. On Monday night, a Venezuelan woman who was holding her young child talked about what happened to her husband, who was injured in the fire.
I have been waiting for their father since 1 p.m. They told me that they were going to hand him over to me, and then at 10 p.m., we started to see smoke billowing from everywhere. Everybody ran away, but they left the men locked in. Everybody was removed from the area, but they left the men locked in. They never opened the door. We have the paperwork here in Ciudad Juarez, but they took him from the streets for no reason. They are taking us for no reason without asking if we have the paperwork or not. If you are a migrant, they take you in the car. It's that simple.
Speaking outside the jail, a Venezuelan man named Raniel Murillo decried the treatment of the men locked inside.
To all of those people who died, the guards could have opened the gates to let them out, because there was only a few meters between the gate that separated them from the migration officers. They didn't open the gate, leaving them locked in. The fire advanced, and they didn't leave. The guards didn't help them because they didn't feel like it. The guards treat you badly.
An official investigation into the fire has not been completed, but on Tuesday, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador said the fire began after migrants set their mattresses on fire to protest conditions. The United Nations Human Rights Office said the fire was a, quote, preventable tragedy. In a statement, the U.N. agency said, quote, we again urge all states to adopt alternatives to immigration detention. We go now to Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, where we're joined by Luis Chaparro, journalist reporting from the U.S.-Mexico border, where his new report for Vice News is just out. It's headlined, They Only Listen to Us When We Die. Migrants killed in fire were locked in jail cell. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Luis, but under horrible circumstances. Explain exactly what you understand happened, as you've talked to so many people there now since Monday night.
Hi, Amy and Juan. Thank you for having me. And yes, absolutely saddened that this happened in the border of Ciudad Juarez, although my opinion is that this is a tragedy that was due to happen. At the center of what happened 24 hours ago is are these detention centers that Mexico claims to be shelters but are no other than jails for immigrants, and that they have really done nothing but just being undocumented in a country that it's a transit country for them. And what goes behind those walls, we don't really know, because these are very opaque and not transparent places where we don't have access as journalists or as NGOs. So we really don't know what else is going on behind these bars. But judging by the video that was just out, when we see these cell guards and these immigration officers walking away like if nothing was happening when flames were already out, show us, like, give us an example of what's really going on behind those bars.
And Luis, could you talk about, there have been some reports that the Mexican government in the last few days especially was cracking down increasingly on the asylum seekers, who many of whom were forced to take odd jobs or in the informal economy just to survive while they were waiting for a decision on their cases. Can you talk about that at all?
Definitely. And that's I think that's what really began the whole tragedy. Most of the migrants from Venezuela, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador have really no place to stay because shelters are at capacity. Some other shelters will only take families if they have kids or women. So male basically are left out to sleep in the streets, in looted houses, and to beg or ask for money in stoplights around the city. Many people in Ciudad Juarez began complaining for the presence of migrants out in the streets, and I think that pushed authorities to combine efforts, to call it one way, between the local police, state police, and the Mexican Institute of Immigration to crack down on people out on the streets. They started grabbing people from early in the morning. My understanding is that they started the raids from 10 in the morning all through the day. They were locking migrants inside this facility with no water, no food, and they didn't even understand why were they being locked up, since many of them actually had documents to be legally in the country for at least 30 more days. So that's why they started protesting inside the immigration center.
And could you talk about the significance of the fact that in a few weeks, in early May, there will be the end of the Title 42 policy in the United States as a result of a Supreme Court decision? There are reports that there are increasing numbers of migrants coming to the border. Do you expect these problems to increase over the next few weeks?
Most definitely. You know, the back and forth and all the confusion around immigration policies has been causing a tragic effect in the immigration community. and from different countries, because they are really confused. Like if they like the app they're using, CBP One, is not working. We recently had a riot in one of the main ports of entry between Ciudad Juarez and El Paso when migrants demanded that someone help them navigate the app, and they tried to get across to get help from CBP officers. So that was just an example to how they feel frustrated and confused. And now many of them are expecting for Title 42 to end, but they don't really know if that's actually going to happen. Although they are arriving at border cities in hopes that Title 42 will end in May, but this is adding a lot of pressure to border cities like Ciudad Juarez and El Paso, and specifically to these institutes like the INM, the Mexican Institute for Immigration, that I don't think it's they really have a capacity to work for and to these migrant community.
Luis, the deaths in Mexico came just hours after the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees urged the Biden administration not to adopt the proposed anti-asylum rule that would deny claims made by refugees who lack, quote, documents sufficient for lawful admission. In a statement, the UN Refugee Agency said the regulation would restrict the fundamental human right to seek asylum, adding, quote, UNHCR is particularly concerned that this would lead to cases of refoulement, the forced return of people to situations where their lives and safety would be at risk, which is prohibited under international law, unquote. So that's the UN's comment. So if you can talk, while this is in Ciudad Juarez, it's literally feet from the border, about the responsibility of the U.S. government as well right now.
Definitely. This is one of the very notable examples of how these migrants are being endangered by these U.S. policies. The U.N. has been warning these for several years now, that these kind of policies are making migrants more and more vulnerable. One of the situations they face, of course, is violence by criminal organizations in Mexican soil. We've been seeing in places like Matamoros, places like Tijuana as well, and Ciudad Juarez, that they've been targeted by criminal organizations to kidnap them, extort them, and in some other cases to actually kill them. And now we have this case where it doesn't only shows you that they're being targeted by criminal organizations, or that they remain vulnerable to criminal organizations, but they also remain vulnerable to a very much corrupt and not transparent government, which is the Mexican government. And this is only happening because of the U.S. Push to keep these policies in place, like Title 42, to name only one of the policies that are endangering migrants.
And Luis, you mentioned the Mexican government. President López Obrador has increasingly, in the past few months, been striking a much more, I don't want to say militant, but independent stance in many of his speeches against the United States. Yet at the same time, he continues to cooperate, essentially, with first the Trump administration and now the Biden administration on the migration issue along the border. Wondering about the contradictions between López Obrador's public statements and the practice of his government on this issue. I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Sure. López Obrador says something and then does something else. And that's been the policy since the beginning of his administration. When he said that Mexico was not going to be militarized, he completely militarized the country, also endangering migrants. Because as of right now, we have probably twice the National Guard members deployed to immigration tasks, immigration enforcement tasks, then we have Border Patrol in both borders of the U.S. That says a lot about how the López Obrador administration is dealing with immigration, which is basically handing immigration tasks to former military and federal police officers that are not well prepared to deal with immigrants or with an immigration community. López Obrador also has been trying to crack down the southern border of Mexico and also enforce the northern border of Mexico. So even though if he's being very, you know, active, saying that he's going to protect its own, it's going to protect his country from U.S. policies that are harming Mexico, I think he has been doing absolutely the opposite, cracking down on immigration. This is probably the first administration that has been so harsh against immigrants in Mexican territory.
In comparisons to Trump, under the Trump years, Luis?
Yes, well, in Trump years, actually, that's when the Mexican administration began. I mean, López Obrador was pretty much complying with everything that former President Donald Trump was trying to do with Mexico. When he said that Mexico was going to pay for the wall, I think that was not literally, but mostly figurative. And I think that's what López Obrador agreed upon, to build and make Mexico jail for immigrants in places like Tapachula, where we have probably even worst cases of these immigration detention facilities, but also by deploying hundreds and hundreds of National Guard members to the northern border, where they are literally grabbing migrants from doing something that is lawful, which is getting across and turning themselves over to Border Patrol agents to apply for political asylum.
Luis Chapata, we want to thank you so much for being with us as you speak to us from Ciudad Juarez in Mexico. We will link to your new report for Vice News, which is just out. They only listen to us when we die. Migrants killed in fire were locked in jail cell. Coming up, award-winning technology journalist Julia Angwin on why banning TikTok is not the answer. Stay with us. Chicos Tristes, The Sad Boys by Hermanos Gutierrez. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As a growing number of governments worldwide enact new limits on social media apps, we look now at bipartisan calls at home to ban one specific app here in the United States, the Chinese-owned TikTok. Last Thursday, Congress members grilled TikTok CEO Shouji Chu during a five-hour hearing on the app's ties to the Chinese government, data practices, and its effects on children's mental health. This is Democratic Florida Congressmember Darren Soto questioning Chu.
So, Mr. Chu, would TikTok be prepared to divest from ByteDance and Chinese Communist Party ties if the Department of Treasury instructed you all to do so?
Congressman, I said in my opening statement, I think we need to address the problem of privacy. I agree with you. I don't think ownership is the issue here. With a lot of respect, American social companies don't have a good track record with data privacy and user security. I mean, look at Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. Just one example.
This comes as a bipartisan group of U.S. senators has introduced the RESTRICT Act, which stands for Restricting the Emergence of Security Threats That Risk Information Communications Technology Act, which would allow the federal government to potentially ban technology from countries the U.S. considers to be adversaries, including China. Meanwhile, Democratic Congressmember Jamal Bowman of New York has been a leading opponent of a TikTok ban.
So we're talking about free speech for everyday Americans. We're talking about small business owners who use TikTok to grow their business. And my question is, and we're going to pivot to the other part of the conversation, why the hysteria and the panic and the targeting of TikTok. As we know, Republicans in particular have been sounding the alarm, creating a red scare around China.
Congressman Bowman has been joined by New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who laid out her concerns in a video she posted on TikTok after opening her first account on the app.
Usually when the United States is proposing a very major move that has something to do with significant risk to national security, one of the first things that happens is that Congress receives a classified briefing. And I can tell you that Congress has not received a classified briefing around the allegations of national security risks regarding TikTok. So why would we be proposing a ban regarding such a significant issue without being clued in on this at all? It just doesn't feel right to me.
For more, we're joined in New York by Julia Angwin, investigative journalist formerly with ProPublica, contributing opinion writer at The New York Times, where her latest guest essay is headlined, How to Fix the TikTok Problem. We last spoke to her in 2014